Brent Brewer is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Brewer to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out a third of U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, Merrill Pontier, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Snyder, general reporter Clinton Young. The Execution Watch for Brent Brewer begins.
Up. Tonight, the state of Texas ushers Brent Brewer into the death chamber. To our listeners around the world, thank you for joining us on this Thursday, November the 9th, 2023 edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue, and if you're tuning in for Progressive Forum on KPFT Houston, they will be back in 2 weeks in their regular Thursday 6 o'clock time slot. Execution Watch is brought to you in part by the Clinton Young Foundation and is produced by a dedicated staff of volunteers. Go to kpft.org and pledge your support to us now as we report live each and every time the state of Texas schedules an execution. The live stream is of this show can be found on our Facebook page as well, and we thank Houston Media Source, as always, for simulcasting. During tonight's broadcast, we will be giving you details about the case, including background surrounding the trial and conviction. We will have expert legal analysis, as well as live reports from Huntsville and breaking news regarding any last-minute judicial information. And we will hear from our newest reporter, who himself is a former death row inmate. Tonight, the state of Texas will execute Brent Brewer for... In 1991, Brent Brewer was sentenced to death for fatally stabbing Robert Lamanick during a robbery. In 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court vacated Mr. Brewer's death sentence, citing the trial court's failure to adequately allow the jury to consider mitigating factor. And yet, here we are. He will be the sixth person to be executed by the state of Texas in 2023. Before we go to Linda Snyder, as we normally do, I'd like to talk a little bit about this case. And so let's introduce our panel now to get some feedback. Joining us tonight are Larry Douglas, our chief legal analyst, Houston criminal defense attorney Patrick McCann, criminal defense attorney Merrill Pontier, and Execution Watch reporter Clinton Young, a former death row inmate. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming in on this stormy and dark night.
Thanks for having us.
Larry, just a little bit, explain the case to us, just a little.
Well, this case, as you mentioned earlier, Marlo, comes out of Amarillo from 1990. Brent Brewer, along with his girlfriend, Christy Nystrom, set out to rob people. His plan was to rob somebody and take their car. He tried on one occasion, and the people just closed the door and drove off. Then he goes to Robert Lamanick. Mr. Lamanick owns an Amarillo floor company, and he asked Mr. Lamanick to give him a ride to the Salvation Army. So he and his girlfriend get in the car, and on the way to the Salvation Army, what happens is Brent Brewer is reported to have grabbed Mr. Lamanick and strangled him and started to stab him. Brewer was in the back seat. Lamanick's driving. The girlfriend is in the front passenger seat. Brewer's trying to pull Lamanick over the back seat. The car is going all over the road. They finally slam to a stall. There is some evidence claiming that 66-year-old Mr. Lamanick was pleading for his life, saying, "Don't kill me, don't kill me." And some evidence suggests that what Brewer did was said that I really don't want to kill you. I just want your money. I just want your car. They then took the car, During the process of the killing, Brewer hurt his hand, and his girlfriend was pretty much covered with blood. So they go back to their roommate's apartment, and they get cleaned up. And then they drive like 300 miles over to a little town called Red Oak, Texas, a little bit south of Dallas. And that's where they picked up. Now, before they went over there, they did go to the hospital to get Brewer's hand sewn up. And so we know that this was a robbery, apparently, a murder occurring during the course of a robbery. So as a result, he was charged with capital murder, and he was convicted by the jury back in 1991, as you mentioned before. I think you're leaving earlier, aren't you saying? So did you want to get to Pat right now?
Well, let's go straight with Pat, because we always, yeah.
In that first trial, the Texas statute at that time lacked a mitigation question. It was on the cusp of the Penry case, which forced people to actually weigh mitigating evidence. That's what got him a second trial. And the frustrating thing on this is that one of the psychologists that testified, Dr. Coons, was someone that the CCA themselves, the Court of Criminal Appeals, eventually said that his methods for determining future dangerousness were improper. And they said that after upholding the second trial where Dr. Coons testified. So the recent lawyers brought that to the fore and tried to get the CCA to reconsider whether or not this was proper. There was also a very moving and heart-wrenching letter from one of the jurors in the case who was confused by the 10-2 rule, which is supposedly you needed 10-2 at least get to your verdict for the jury for life. The problem is that that's not correct. Under the statute, a single vote for life would render the death penalty ineligible for him, and the court would have to impose a sentence of life and declare a mistrial.
Okay, Pat, just a quick. So the Penry issue, okay, well, the Dr. Coons testimony, yep, that came in the first trial,
yep,
okay, there was no possibility of mitigation at that time.
That's correct.
For the death penalty. But then now, Dr. Coons' junk science, as was referred to, he can predict, suppose he can predict future dangerousness, having not even ever having interviewed Brewer.
That's correct.
He said this man is going to be a future, and future danger is necessary for the death penalty.
Yeah, that's the first question that one has to answer in the modern statute. It's, is there a likelihood that he's going to commit criminal acts of violence that would be a danger to society? And with that, there was no mitigation question for them to weigh the other things in his life, such as abuse, drug problems, mental health issues. And that came in later.
Okay. Now, Brewer had two punishment hearings.
Yep.
Okay. So the first one at the first trial.
Yes.
Okay. We've got Dr. Coons' testimony came in that one.
Correct.
He was found guilty and sentenced to the death penalty at that point.
Yes.
That verdict, that punishment assessed death, was overturned because of?
Because of the lack of a mitigation question. Under his initial sentence, the jury had no vehicle to give a reasoned moral response to any evidence they saw for mitigation or mercy. And the Texas statute had in fact changed right after his trial, and they included a mitigation question that we still have now. And he never got the advantage of that, so the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional and sent it back for a second punishment.
Okay, as a result of the change in law.
Yes.
Okay, great. And so now he gets that second punishment hearing. And at this time, the death sentence, in order to impose the death sentence, the jury has to unanimously require that.
Yes.
Okay. And so for whatever reason, this juror was mistaken by that? Is that what the argument is?
There's a part of the Article of Criminal Procedure that explains that in order to give a no vote, you need two jurors to go with a 10-2. It's not actually true, but we're not allowed to explain that, or we weren't in those days. And when she was given that option to decide, she said she was the only holdout, so she did not realize that she could have caused a life sentence to be imposed. If someone held out and held out either no future dangerousness or yes, there was mitigation, then the judge had to, under the statute, impose a sentence of life, because the only way to get to a death was by unanimity. So she believed that her vote was meaningless, and she did not speak up and went along with the rest of the jurors, and she now regrets that, at least according to the article.
So do you think this letter had any kind of leverage whatsoever?
And again,
for our listeners, this was a letter that someone on the juror actually wrote and had printed in our local paper, which is the Houston Chronicle.
I can't imagine it not having an effect on anyone who read it, but the problem is that that's potentially a good clemency plea. And I think that was why it was put forward.
Mm-hmm.
But if I may be so bold, clemency is a rigged game in this state. It always has been. Unless you have tremendous, powerful backers or are someone who's in the good graces of our dear Governor Abbott, you have as much chance of getting clemency as you have of being struck by lightning.
Right.
So that is an unfortunate truth, and that was a wonderful and heartfelt attempt to reach the people on the Board of Pardons and Paroles, but they're Governor Abbott's appointees, and frankly, it's a waste of time
right
at this point, and has been for years. It was different.
We're going to get right back to that, but let's go first to our reporter who is in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Linda, do you have some?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Well, they crossed at 712. They crossed the street and got into a van because when they had the fire, it messed up where they can go in at. So they have to drive around to the back side of the building to go in.
Oh, that's where the other ones go in.
So, okay. So instead of going in the front way, which we are used to, they are now taking them via van into the back, and we will see the van come back when they finish. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. We'll see the van when it comes back.
All right. Linda, thank you very much. We will come right back to you. We're going to take advantage of Pat right now while we have him. Thank you very much. Pat McCann. Yeah, of course.
Isn't there also in the statute, it says about the admissibility of juror statements? I mean, there's a court ruling that says that juror statements are inadmissible,
no,
unless it's actual misconduct or something.
There's an evidence rule called 606
right
that prohibits you from going into jurors' deliberations. However, the Supreme Court has carved out a racism exception.
In the Colorado case. Yeah.
And they have stuck by that, but generally speaking, absent evidence of an outside influence or actual misconduct that would probably shock the conscience. For instance, I'm not even sure in Texas that a juror making a slur of some sort would actually cause them to invalidate it, unless they could get other jurors to say.
I think there was a case like that not so long ago where a guy was executed. I think there was actually a case like that where the jury made comments. Yeah. It was out of Lubbock, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but they still executed
it. Lubbock or somewhere up in the Panhandle area.
Well, I still want to go back to rigged game, but I'm going to move on. relating to tonight's execution, are some of the things that are puzzling to you about the Court of Criminal Appeals decision this week?
Look, they had a case where their own decision had indicated that the evidence for future dangerousness was flawed.
Right.
That decision was written by Judge Cochran. In a different case, why they would not apply that to him, I'm baffled.
How can they apply things so arbitrarily? I'm sorry.
Believe me, there's...
I know it's...
Well, the CCA said that decision came in 2010 or 2011, mm-hmm. and they decided Brent Brewer's new punishment phase was in 2009. So that came 1 year before the CCA opinion. So actually, the CCA said it did not matter, and his attorneys could also not have... could not have known that, you know, a year later, that testimony would not have been admissible. But also, if it was not admissible, there's still all this other evidence in the case that indicates future dangerousness, such as the crime itself. And I think one or two things that he supposedly did when he was awaiting trial in a county jail.
Does anybody know what that is?
Yeah, he got into like a scuffle in the county jail. I mean,
yeah, he made a threat.
Yeah, I mean, that's
a verbal threat.
Yeah.
Yeah, or just if you get into altercation in the county, if you don't get in an altercation in the county jail with somebody, a guard or somebody, then there's something wrong with you.
And the state will say if you don't get in an altercation, they say you rigged the system.
Yeah, you're manipulating the system.
Yeah.
Like if you don't get a disciplinary case on death row, then they say that you're gaming the system.
But otherwise, his he had a pretty good record.
Yeah, I mean,
on death row.
Yeah.
I mean, he was not disciplined. He was I think the
he had no.
I don't think he
level,
ever had. I don't think level, he ever had a disciplinary
level
case.
One.
He had no.
But he didn't go. I mean, like I said, he barely went to rec. He just stayed in the cell. He went to shower, came back. I mean, so matter of fact, in what's his name, Dr. Coons?
Yeah.
Coons. Yes.
Yeah, he testified in the first trial, saying,
yeah,
oh, he had this method that he came up with of predicting future danger. But in the next trial, it was like, oh, well, he didn't get a case because he's facing execution, so therefore he knows he has to play the game and stay out of trouble. You know, like that just proves he's manipulative and dangerous because he ain't got in trouble in prison. And so they turned around and played that against him too, right? But you're saying about the, you know, he had this whole method of, to him was a science, but he became junk science, of saying future dangerousness. Well, now they just say, it's in my professional opinion that he will more likely than not be a threat to other people.
In the service, we had a phrase for that, FMA.
Yeah.
And that's a frustrating thing. Like this Richard Coons, he testified in 1990, I think his trial was. And then 20 years later, it was shown that his testimony was false or incorrect, at least, because Brent Brewer didn't catch a case.
Yep.
So he had a perfect record on death row. And then the state still put him up again as a witness for future dangerousness. And yeah, like Clinton says, he says, well, he's still going to be a future danger because, people on death row are just meant to behave.
There's no mechanism for correcting a wrong guess by the jury or correcting wrong information that gets into the jury's hands.
Should psychological evidence be admitted to a jury weighing a death decision?
I'd like to say yes, because on so many of our cases, if we get the information that we need to give them, the information about somebody having tremendous trauma in their lives, somebody having real schizophrenia where you're not hearing good voices and they are actually taking over your mind, to get that information in front of a jury, we need to be able to do that, but that's not future dangerousness evidence. That's mitigation. I think there needs to be a real, the Supreme Court has held that it is admissible in Barefoot v. Estelle, but there needs to be a relook at that, because right now in the current system, there are at least 100 guys up on the row that have minimal or no discipline histories, and or have dropped off dramatically from any discipline problems as they've aged.
Right.
And I think for everybody out there, it's no myth that, you know, as men get older, we get tired.
That's true. We all do.
But unfortunately, though, Pat, the law allows for the facts of the underlying case to be used.
It does.
As a way of, which is, you know, just and then the facts in this case are pretty gory. It was a murder. It didn't have to be a capital, but you know, you have the family coming forward and testifying,
sure,
as to what all happened to him. You have the and on the second punishment hearing, Brewer testified himself.
Yeah, that probably didn't help.
And he took responsibility,
right,
for what he had done, thinking that was going to help him. I don't know that it did. And by this time, his co-defender, who had pled out, so this is Christy Nystrom, she'd already pled to a life sentence.
Right.
So she came back and testified to fill in some of the gaps of what happened during the murder, and then he, with his testimony, I think it was almost like he was confessing to then say, I'm repentant, I've confessed, I repented, and maybe it'll save his life. But when you have Dr. Coons' testimony coming back and saying, he's still now a future danger. Forget about the last 20 years.
Yep.
Now we can say he's a future danger while he's in TDC, although he has not been a danger to anybody in TDC. So far, I can tell, I can predict.
Yeah, I can predict. It's such utter bullshit, and it's very straightforward on this, but it is, and for this reason, you cannot get to a place where you can pick and choose which evidence you want to bring. In other words, if a guy has 20 years of good history, then that comes in, and it has to matter and be given weight. If the guess before was wrong, then you have to be able to rebut it and go back and talk to the psychiatrist or psychologist and say, weren't you discredited? And that is what is not allowed in trials, or despite a lot of effort, oftentimes even in habeas, when you try and come back with good evidence about this. It is frustrating.
You know, a lot of times, too, it's like when she's asked about psychological evidence, you know, the courts have ruled that, and this is true, a lot of times, even something that we could deem mitigating, such as schizophrenia, okay, it's a double-edged sword. Because a juror sitting there, some good old boy sitting there, he's like, okay, that makes him more dangerous. And so you're asking for mercy. But then the presentations for mercy, the interpretation is, well, I got to put him down. He's a rabid dog. And so the courts acknowledge that, hey, a lot of times this evidence can be double-edged, a double-edged sword.
There was a prosecutor once who, when the development of mental retardation evidence was becoming a necessary thing to review, it was pre-Atkins v. Virginia. That prosecutor is now retired, but he said once, well, I don't see how being retarded is a helpful thing. If he's retarded, he can't learn. So,
I mean, that's just, was, yeah, it's just, yeah, you got attitude. Presentation, you got interpretation. I mean, it's just how a lot of stuff is. I mean, and
this is what they say. And they know their jurors. They know the jurors that they want to reach on those things, and exactly that argument is what they will do. You can't take a chance with this guy.
And when you talk about, like he said, made a comment about you know, the weight that's given to the juror. Like, if you're a prosecutor and I'm a defense attorney and you put on an expert that says one thing and I put on an expert that says the other thing, then the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to say, well, the jurors are the final fact finders. They were able to analyze both sets of testimony and they came to an informed decision and decided to negate the defense expert and go with the state's expert. The problem is when the state uses experts such as Coons, you know, it's like the jury's hanging their hat on a clown.
Well, why would they use the same expert twice anyway?
Because they get death verdicts.
Yeah.
They reinforce the death verdict when they get them in. Dr. Death, a little bit before that, and Coons are of a stripe of expert for hire that the state used ruthlessly because they could make it real simple for the jurors. He's always going to be a future danger. There's no way you can't acknowledge that, and you have to put him down for that.
Can I ask you a quick question? You're not going to be here with us for David Rentiero if the execution goes on next week. But you're doing a training. Can you tell us what this is about?
It's just TCDLA, the statewide criminal organization, has put on a program up in Dallas, and I'll be training people on motions and jury charges.
What kind of people?
Capital offense lawyers, both new and old, me being on the old side. But hopefully this will be something good because the joy in this work is not only victory or staving off a problem, but doing a good job for people that perhaps gets them out of one of these cases. And creative motions work and creative jury charges are becoming more necessary, especially in this time when the feds are turning much more conservative in the court system. So we can't look to them for the relief that we used to get. We have to find reasons in the state constitution or that will appeal to the CCA. For instance, the woman from St. Mary's, Donna Coulthart, forgive me if I mispronounce her name, but she came up with a state law provision that attacked the jurisdiction of the special prosecuting unit as to whether or not they could seek death. I haven't seen the full opinion, but it appears that's the only thing that caught the CCA's eye. So kudos to her for creativity on that, and I'm hoping to encourage other people at this training to come up with something new and fun to try, because it can't hurt.
I know you're about to leave, but I'll ask this to everyone. Do you feel that this has been a miscarriage of justice, what's happening to Brent Brewer?
I do on this. This was a tragedy. An old man tried to give some people a hand, and he lost his life because of it. Brewer was 19. Brewer stood up and repented. Brewer has never hurt anybody on death row, not a guard, not another inmate. He has never caused injury to anyone. He's never set a fire. He is, in actuality, someone who has become a normal, a rule-abiding inmate. To kill this man now is a waste. And it is a miscarriage because you're killing him for a prediction by a quack that was wrong.
And they know he's wrong.
I say for beyond the fact of his behavior, the big issue for me is in American jurisprudence, our jury system is sacred. They always say we don't have the best system, but we have the best system out there and compared to other worlds because all over the world, because a juror of your peers, which is never actually your actual peers, but people from society can sit down and hear the government's case and then make this decision. Okay. And so.
Thank you, Pat.
If it's sacred, then if you sit there and ignore when a juror comes forward and says, look, I misunderstood or I was bullied into this decision, then you disrespect the so-called sacredness of your system if you don't acknowledge this flaw and do something about it. You know, it's either is the jury sacred or not. It can't be, you know, oh, we pick when it's sacred when we won't. Just like when their materiality analysis in habeas corpus, they say, oh, well, yes, that was wrong that the prosecutor lied and said you killed three people you didn't kill. But is it material? Well, no, the jury could have still sentenced you to death based on the nature of the crime.
Right.
All right. And so that's why I say that, unfortunately, the court system, you know, they pick and choose where they want to apply these things. And you asked earlier a question about doing that, like there's a case law, why is it so arbitrary?
Right.
You know, studying the law down there, especially when you first start, and anybody that's written a guy in prison that touches the law, like you read a case law, like, man, that's my case. I'm gonna get out of here.
Yeah.
But then you don't realize there's like all kinds of other stuff that surrounds this.
Right.
And then you also have the CCA's application of that. Because there is, I know 20, if I know one guy's on death row that could get out right now if you took a non-death penalty case and applied there to it. But for some reason, when it comes to the death penalty, capital litigation is a realm of its own. And it's like we have a bifurcated appeal system within the court rulings.
Yeah.
Because it's not applied equally across the board.
And so they kind of trick those jurors into sentencing someone to death with the way the law's written, and that is the unfairness of this system, and that's why it's an injustice, and Brand's execution is an injustice, and it's, you know, we have this letter from this juror, which we don't have in many other cases, but of course this applies to many other cases. So you have supposedly a jury that is representative of you know, the public, the people, which it's not, because if you're against the death penalty, you can't be on it. So you have, you know, 12 people who are in practice capable of sentencing someone to death, and you have one that says, I did not think he was a future danger. I did not think he acted with premeditation. She wanted to sentence him to life at that point, but because the way the law's written, she thought the law would not allow her to do so. And so you're kind of tricking jurors into giving someone a death sentence. And
so because of the way that the law was written, or because of the way that the law was presented to the jurors?
The way it was written, because if I read it, and I would not know better, I would think the same. It says if you you cannot answer the first two special issues with no, unless you have at least 10 people. And so, but it doesn't say that when you don't have 10 people, or you can't make any decision at all, it's going to be automatic life. The law doesn't say that.
Yeah, they don't say that a hung jury on punishment phase is automatic life.
Right.
Like if it's 10-2 and there's not two, if there's just one person on special issue one of future danger, it says, yeah, I don't think this dude's a future danger. He was whacked out on crack or drunk or whatever and done this. So, nah, I ain't going to do it. They don't realize that stops the proceedings.
Right.
You know, right. And then it's confusing because the whole intent.
Well, how would they know?
Right. And it's just
unless
way,
somebody
and
you tells them, how would you?
Yeah, you really
can't tell them.
You couldn't really tell them, like, hey, look, if you say this right here, then this is what the end result is. Because the way the whole system is even designed is when a jury, it's presented in such a way that the jury itself has not sentenced you to death.
Yeah.
The jury just answers a series of questions. And based on those questions, the judge then has to sentence you in accordance to the law of yes, yes, no, then that equals a death sentence. Like used to back in the day, like you could even, on parole, there were certain issues related to parole that you couldn't even talk about to a jury. So they designed it in such a way to basically result in more death sentences.
Do they make more money when they give the death penalty?
It costs the taxpayers more money.
Costs the taxpayers more money.
A lot more money.
Why?
Just who make more
the
money?
The prosecutor.
Who's making the money?
Oh, I mean, the prosecutor gets a salary, so he's not. I mean, it costs the state. Defense lawyers, I guess. I mean, but it's like they're not doing it for profit. They might get the glory or the satisfaction of accomplishing the death penalty. Like used to, they had the Silver Needle Society, and they had like a little plaque with a needle on it for whenever a prosecutor got the death sentence. And so, but that wasn't a state-sanctioned award. You know, that was just something that prosecutors came up with. But they don't make more money from it, you know.
And really, I think the issue of money sort of goes out the window because to the people who are involved in the system,
right,
it's not real money because it's not their money.
Yeah, it's taxpayers.
So it's taxpayers' money, which means to people in the system, it's like free money. So that's I don't think is really even an issue.
No.
But a big issue is the competition. We relegate this to a competition between two lawyers. And we asked a question earlier about, well, the issue at this point is, what should have been done? Was this a just verdict? And why did they use Dr. Coons on both punishment hearings? The simple answer is that it works. He gets that business, and he's paid to render an opinion and give testimony that's going to get a guy killed. And so at this point, what we have is the prosecutors have a tremendous amount of discretion as to whether they seek the death penalty or don't seek the death penalty. What Brent Brewer did in the murder was reprehensible. But there have been murders a whole lot worse than that, a whole lot worse. And if the prosecutor decides I'm seeking the death penalty, in many instances, the way the law is structured, he very well might be able to get it. And so they have the witnesses who have been tried and true to be able to make the case, present persuasive evidence to a jury that's going to convince them to give the death penalty. That's really what they're looking for.
Yeah,
and money's not an issue.
Just for those of us who are listening on KPFT, it is 6:37 in the evening. Today is Thursday, of course, November the 9th. If you are here to listen to Progressive Forum, it will be back in a couple of weeks. But you are listening right now to Execution Watch. We are here for Brent Brewer, who has already, the witnesses have already gone ahead and crossed the road, as we like to say, and we are waiting to hear back from Linda Snyder in, Linda, any news for us?
Yes, they have not come back yet.
All right. Did you know Brent?
Yes, he was a very nice guy, and he was, you know, 30 years he was incarcerated with not even one bad mark against his name.
Wow.
No disciplinary cases or anything. So this is just wrong.
30 years.
I used to not be able to go 30 days.
Right.
So, I mean, 30 years. I mean, ah, dang.
So have we completely lost the concept of forgiveness in our system? Is our judicial system so hell-bent on just getting these convictions that we don't pay attention to the fact that we are killing a person who is no longer the same person he was 30 years ago?
Right.
I mean, I don't. You often wonder about, because like sometimes they seem bloodthirsty, and they say, like, it goes back to, they say, well, the sacredness of the jury's decision,
right,
and us not second guessing the jury, you know.
Yeah.
And so, but then they turn around and ignore the jury when they say, hey, I was confused, or I didn't want to do that, or that's not what I said, or, and so, I mean, it's, I can't sit there and get into their mind.
Well, no, but,
you know, I mean, to me, sometimes it seems like they like killing. Huh? That's, I mean,
yeah.
I'm like, dang, y'all call us the sociopaths.
You know, I was listening today to the web seminar that was going on with the Innocence Project, and one of the things that they were talking about specifically is how people, the general public's view of what's going on in prisons and in the death penalty cases, is so tainted by what they see on television and in the media. And, you know, they watch forensic shows and they believe that everybody's, that they're going to get these detailed analyses within a day of what's going on because they see this evidence on television. And it is so untrue of what's actually representative in our judicial system. How do we change that?
Well, that's true for the entire judicial system, whether it's the death penalty or just the smash and grab. When you watch TV, that's entertainment. And people have to understand that that's all it is. And so you can't judge the entire legal system based on what you see on TV. And, but that goes with almost any profession, the medical system or anything like that, because everything is just that's just solely for entertainment. The thing that gets me the most about this case, though, is the realty, the reality of the position that Brent Brewer found himself in. That is, he's trying to keep maintain his life, but he's got to turn that over to lawyers, okay? And you've got these experts who come forward and testify one way against him. And so the court says, well, your lawyers could have done a better job of refuting that testimony. He says, okay, well, my lawyers are, I think, gave me ineffective assistance of counsel. And you say, well, and there's nothing he can do about that. Well, we don't find it to be ineffective. It just could have been better. That's the flavor I get from reading some of the underlying information that he's in that position, and there's nothing he can do because he's got to depend on his lawyers, and whether the lawyer's doing a great job or a terrible job, he has no way of knowing. Sometimes they know, but if the court is going to be critical of the lawyer's representation to some degree, in terms of keeping out evidence, then should the defendant have the benefit of complaining about the lawyer, saying, well, the lawyer didn't do a good job? Well, that's just tough.
And they did try. I mean, they tried to, via a pretrial hearing, try to get that testimony out.
Yes.
They came up with their own expert who testified on the future dangerousness, and that expert said he's not going to be future dangerous. So the
yes.
jury heard that, too, and plus mitigating evidence. So that's why the... plus the fact that his testimony, Kuhn's testimony, was not discredited yet by the CCA because it came a year later. So the court said, well, your lawyers are not ineffective because they could not have known that at the time. And that's the unfairness.
That's the very point that got me, yeah. How are the lawyers going to know?
Well, see, there's a to comment at 2 points that Larry said, real quick, because you asked the question about the experts, why they go to them, because they're tried and true. No prosecutor wants to go with an expert that might not be able to stand up to the vigorous cross-examination by a defense attorney, so they go with the tried and true. Like, hey, who you got? Oh, man, he went good against every lawyer we put against, that the defense puts against them, right? And so that's why they generally use the same experts, because they're tried and true. On this issue, there's actually a case law where a guy raised an issue about prosecutor or police and things that were done in his trial in that regard. And they denied him, saying his lawyer should have objected. It's understood that case law evolves. I say, so any lawyer should know that it doesn't matter if the case law is in your favor now, you still object to preserve the record. And so the lawyer made a strategic decision not to object. Therefore, Strickland doesn't apply. But then in this situation, they're saying, well, there's no way the lawyer could have been a fortune teller and seen that this law would have changed or this expert would have been banned. And so, therefore, the lawyer is not ineffective. And that's the problem with the CCA. It goes back to what we were saying earlier, is that I can find you a case law that says one way this, and then 5 years later or sometimes 5 months later, there's another case law that contradicts. And so it's just like the McCoy claims, and they say a defendant, if he doesn't stand up and like scream out in the Barbie case, he just said, hey, you know, I'm innocent. Well, he didn't explicitly say that that's not the defense that his lawyer didn't want to put on. Yeah. Well, what part of innocent doesn't mean I don't want this dude to say I'm guilty? I mean, like, But they tell you in court, if you yell out, we're going to gag you or hit you with a stun gun. And so people are afraid to yell out, and nobody wants to look disruptive in court. And so, but then the CCA doesn't let you speak out on yourself, of course. And they say, well, if the defendant didn't speak up, then tough luck. You get executed.
And if you do speak out.
Yeah, and if you do speak out, then, well, he was disruptive in court.
Right.
So the jury was right in finding him a future danger. And so it's like, it's kind of like...
It's a rigged system.
Yeah, it's just...
Well, the other thing is, we're talking about witnesses, whether you're talking about expert witnesses or lay witnesses.
Right.
There are just some people who are just flat out persuasive. You they sit there and they talk, and people just believe them. And sometimes they're just lying, okay, or just not telling, just swaying the truth, shading the truth. And there are just some people who are just flat believable, and others who know the information and say almost the same thing, and people just don't believe them. So if you've got a persuasive witness, that carries a lot of weight, a whole lot of weight, and the parent of Coons must be pretty persuasive also.
Except for this juror.
except for this.
You get somebody up there and they say they have all these degrees and all this other stuff, and so jurors start to go for it. Like, there was a forensic pathologist out of Mississippi that did an astronomical amount of autopsies in a year, that the autopsy people say, the board said, that this wouldn't be
talked about.
It wouldn't be possible to do this many autopsies in a year. It's not humanly possible. And in one case out of Louisiana, they even brought the dude down to Louisiana. He said that he could tell that this 12-year-old little black kid that was on trial for murder, he got on the stand and said, told the jury that he could tell by the bullet wound that his sister, because the question was asked, well, how's this little boy going to hold this big pistol? And he said, well, he could tell by the bullet wound that his sister was reaching around him, holding his hands as he held this big old 357 Magnum and shot somebody by the bullet. And then the youngster's case was denied because they say, well, the jury could weigh the evidence. But you got 12 uneducated people who don't know nothing about the law, more... You know, they don't know nothing about forensic pathology besides watching a CSI episode.
Right.
And so they're supposed to make the informed decision based on a bunch of
BS. Well, there's a lot to be said about gang mentality. When you get into a room, when you are locked into a room and somebody says, you have power, there is something about a gang mentality that is persuasive.
Yeah, I mean, the mob.
It's not right, but it's persuasive.
Yeah, you have somebody that sits in there, and like, if you have a jury foreman, for example, well, in America, we're generally raised to respect authority, defer to the person that's picked to be our voice. And so the jury basically votes and says, hey, that's going to be my, or we're going to agree, do you be a jury foreman? And he kind of leaves the charge. And it's more likely not the person that's more leaning towards would be convicting somebody that wants to take that role.
Right.
And so a lot of jurors, they get pressured in. I mean, there's been time and time again where they say, look, I was pressured in. I mean, not everybody can stand up to a forceful personality, you know. And
that's some of the things that we've been talking about, the juror.
Right.
I think her name is Michelle Douglas.
Yes.
No relation. Okay. But it can be persuasive to be there with the group.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out what should I do. And that's why it's so important to make sure the jurors can stand on their own. But some people just can't do it or don't do it. And she decided that, well, rather than voting my conscience, apparently what she's saying, rather than voting my conscience, it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
And so had I known it made a difference, that is, had I been properly instructed, then I would have voted differently. That's critical.
Absolutely.
That's critical.
She says in this, and I'm just going to read it directly if you all don't mind, believing incorrectly that my vote was meaningless, I acquiesced in the majority's death penalty verdict.
That's powerful.
That is just in... Just and now a man is losing his life, even though there was one person who could have changed that. This is
This yeah, it's either sacred or it's not. You know, that's what the folks got to decide, right? It's like, is this your sacred system? And if you do, sometimes you win some, sometimes you lose some. But it doesn't matter. What matters is that you do the right thing.
Right. We're not just flipping a coin.
Right.
That's why I thought it would be powerful for clemency, but nobody on the Texas Board of Partisan Paroles actually voted in favor. It was unanimously rejected, even with this letter, and they sent that in. Not to say that she didn't make a difference. You know, if she's listening tonight, I think she definitely did make a difference because of all the people that read this.
Yeah, she did.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
it's very, very powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah, there might be a future juror that reads that.
Yeah.
And then that person, when they get on a jury, is like, no, I'm not giving in. You know?
Well, education. That's part of the reason why we have this show, is that people need to know that they are part of this process as well. We're not telling you how to make a decision. We're not telling you who to vote for. But we are telling you to pay attention because we all have rights. Linda, thank you for being with us for so long. And I know that you visit these people often. You are what we often long called a death row angel. And
yes,
can you, I don't want you to be, you know, tell us conversations or anything, but can you tell us how they feel when they realize that such a miscarriage of justice is going on?
Well, it hurt. Another thing I want to tell you is the family just came back across. I think the sister was a witness, and then two news people, and they just came back from out of the building.
Michael? Was Michael there? Okay. Thank you. Thank you
and
so much.
Yes, I do see I see the guys, and I know the first time I went to visit, I thought I was going to see monsters. They're not monsters. No. They're human beings.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And let's just say so ends the life of Mr. Brent Brewer. Rest in peace, Brent Ray Brewer.
Well,
May your passing help the healing of those who demanded it and the state who endorsed it. Clint.
Oh, yeah, real quick. Like, you know, Brent never got in trouble down there. He was a quiet dude, right, man? So he wasn't a threat to nobody. The state gains nothing by executing them. I mean, it's been 30, 40 years. But something else I wanted to point out is that I don't think this was covered, was the reason why there's not an interview for Brent Brewer is because TDC blocked him because the victim's family said they didn't want to hear the interview. You know, and so that's why they wasn't able to record it because, you know, and first of all, Texas Constitution allows more, a better the free speech laws within Texas Constitution is greater than the United States Constitution, the federal Constitution. And so I would say that in Texas, we actually have a better access towards free speech, media, and et cetera. But because the victim's family said that they didn't want him to do something, okay, well, victims' families have said they didn't want a man to be killed in their name, but they still killed the man. And so now, because the victim family said that, oh, well, I don't think he should be able to speak. You know, it's not to take nothing away from the victim's family, and I understand they have their pain and their suffering, right? And I'm not trying to negate that in any shape, form, or fashion. But a man never loses his right to be heard. Like, that's something I believe wholeheartedly. And for TDC to do that, I mean, it's blatantly illegal. Code of Criminal Procedure at the very beginning, it talks about free speech. And so they were, you know, because if what's his name with Associated Press goes in there, they're going to let him go in there.
Michael Krzyzewski.
Right, because they know what kind of article he's going to write. And so, but they won't let Execution Watch go in there. You know, it's just like, that's a new one. I've never seen TDC, you know, do that before.
Neither had I, but they do have new people.
So yeah, well,
we know that there is, of course, a new warden. We know that there is a new public information officer. We are learning as quickly as we can how to get around with everyone. We are not unprofessional people. We are very professional people and would like them to be professional as well.
Look, they just need to follow the law. They expect me to follow the law. They expect me to follow the rules. They need to follow the law. They need to follow the rules.
Yes, that's true. We're coming now to the end. Do you have anything else you'd like to say, Larry?
No, I mean, I just want to wish that the family is able to recover from this. I wish them all the best, that their loved one was murdered years ago. I wish comfort for them, and I also wish comfort for the family of Brent Brewer. This is a two people have died as a result of this whole matter, and any death is a tragedy as far as I'm concerned.
Really is. Yep. Well, if you're saying prayers, say a little prayer for Christy Lynn Nystrom, because she's not going to be having a very good day today either, for sure. Meryl?
Well, I think since Brent was not allowed to speak, and Clint did spend almost 20 years with him on death row, maybe we could just end with some words about Brent coming from him.
Yeah, I mean, whatever they say he was at the time of his trial is not the man he is today, right?
He
developed friends while he was down there. I mean, he wrote to people around the world. He made the conscious decision to not be violent and disruptive. And that shows a personal growth. It shows, remorse. It shows changing who you are to become a better person, right? And
thank you. Thank you very much. And we will continue this, of course. Thanks to everyone. That brings to a close this edition of Execution Watch for Thursday, November 9th, 2023. Our next scheduled broadcast date is Thursday, November 16th, as Texas prepares to send David Rentiera into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. We welcome your opinions. Please check our pages. A very special thanks to our crew, to Larry Douglas, to Pat McCann, to Merle Pontier. I'll have to get used to it. Linda Snyder and Clinton Young, video director Mark Pirtle, Otis McClay, Howard Reynolds, Sarah Sheridan, Elise Binch, and to our producer, executive producer Elizabeth Ann Stein. Just a reminder, please support Execution Watch. If you're listening live right now on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for People of Earth with Jacqueline Baptiste. This has been Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. Thank you very much. Good night.
I'll keep y'all's head up on the road.
Yay. Don't you know, some accused are innocent.